Reskillions.
Hey, this is Katie, and you're tuned in to Reskillions, a podcast about skills, the resilience they bring, and living closer to the ground so we don't have quite so far to fall if our fragile modern systems fail us. Can you recite that intro yet? Is it becoming a little stale? As a writer, I've always tried to avoid repeating myself, thirsty for new words, new ideas, new stories. So I've really got to G myself up to reel off the resilience spiel again and again like a radio jingle. But actually, isn't nature constantly repeating herself? And aren't we glad? The sun rises, the waves lap, the hearts beat, the seasons cycle, the cells divide. Pretty good things to copy and paste. Poets know the power of repetition, and oral cultures too. We're wired for the same old, words, songs, stories told and retold, embedded in the body and passed between people, the drumbeat of culture. So perhaps we need less diversity of content and more contented repetition, huddling around a handful of myths and fables and iconic tales to deepen our bonds, re-establish shared meaning. Perhaps repetition is the cure for internalized progress, dropping us into circular time. There's nothing lost in the retelling of a story, says Claire Dunn. So I'm thinking that a useful skill to add to the resilience handcrafted leather bum bag is not just how to tell a story, sing a song or hold a ritual, but how to get comfortable doing so again and again, even if it feels a bit naff, even when novelty beckons. As we turn towards winter in the Southern Hemisphere, campfire stories will be coming into season. And what better co-conspirators in the yarning arts than kids? Kids know that nothing is lost in the retelling of a good story. Otherwise, they wouldn't want you to reread The Very Hungry Caterpillar 17 times before bed. If you have little people in your life, you might notice their predilection for repetition, their innate love of rhythm and routine. You might also wonder how these natural instincts and wisdoms and joys can possibly withstand the damaging winds of Western culture. You may, like the listeners who've reached out to me requesting more kidskillions, be keen to join the dots between parenting and activism. How to grow a beautiful parallel paradigm in and through and with our youngsters. I'm not a parent, but I am someone who believes that our impact, in air quotes, starts at home and can quite happily end there. That the work of our times begins with ourselves and the beings in our orbit, necessarily. So I reached out to one of the greatest women I know, who also happens to be a parenthood black belt. Her name is Devon Harris, and she's here to school us in aware parenting, which is a thrillingly disruptive alternative to parenting as usual. Devon is a parenting coach, consultant, and mother who helps just as many kiddos as she does adult people, because the aware parenting approach is relevant to everyone, especially, as I discovered, to our petulant civilization that's stuck somewhere between the terrible twos and angsty teenage years. We talk about compassion and non-punitive discipline, power reversal games and listening partners, community childcare and schools as feedlots. I loved this conversation and feel great about bringing it to resilience and grateful to Devon for being such a wise and hilarious guest. Sid, Devon's kid, was also hanging out as we recorded, so you'll have the pleasure of hearing from him too. So without further ado, here's Devon Harris to show us just how radically rewarding raising children can be.
Hello, testing, testing, Devon's microphone, testing.
Tell me what you had for breakfast this morning.
I had 2 pancakes with tahini and then I had an apple crumble muffin from Cliffy's.
How would you introduce yourself?
No idea. That's how I'd introduce myself.
You'd start by saying hi, guys.
Hi, guys.
Hi, guys. I have no idea how to intro this podcast. Yeah.
You have a chicken?
Yes, we have 1 chicken. And everyone said...
The plot thickens.
Yeah, she'll go mad if you leave it. She's happy as she thinks it's brilliant. She had a buddy, but the buddy got nicked by a fox because the buddy was a bit, wanted to get out and roam the neighbourhood. She gets out, but she comes back at, 6 o'clock every evening and says, excuse me, can you put me back now?
Oh, you've got a coop in your backyard? Okay, yeah. This isn't a bedroom chicken.
No, I mean, she's inside a fair bit, which is not
Does she shit everywhere?
Yes. Well, not everywhere, but, you know, I've got a tolerance of, like, I can pick up three and then I'm like, right, you're out. And so she can hold on for long enough. She gets to stay in for longer. And I think she's kind of cottoned onto it.
Are you parenting a chicken?
Or is she parenting me?
I thought, actually, that's a really interesting thought that's just struck me. Can you apply aware parenting to anything?
Yeah. Yeah. Anything and everything. Yeah.
Amazing.
A whole world of emotions and feelings and thoughts and ideas inside of everything.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the big reasons I wanted to bring the parenting thread into the resilience braid that works is because I feel like even if you don't have kids or don't want anything to do with kids and never intend on having them in your life, it's actually vital to understand how to manage ourselves and how to nurture ourselves and also then by extension the civilization that we're a part of. And I really love I love Charles Eisenstein so much, and I've heard him repeat time and again that, you know, we exalt these key figures in history like Mother Teresa and Martin Luther King, but they had parents who allowed them to be the people they are. How do you see the connection between parenting and this very wounded society that we seem to be living in?
Mm, such a big question.
Just start small.
Yeah, it is everything. You're right. And it's not everything at the same time. There's just as many incredible achievers that have had, you know, extraordinarily traumatic upbringings. But you're right. It's, you know, with the aware parenting that we're just talking about, you know, this is about being able to parent yourself, being able to coach and guide and, you know, reframe and, you know, make more empowered meaning out of life circumstances and situations. And this is a framework that means that we can do that for our children, but yeah, we can also do that for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, what would you say about your own parenting, as in, the people who raised you?
Mm. I think that, and you know, the line of, you know, they did the best that they could with the knowledge and information they had at the time and with the resources around them and in the, you know, in the context of society, you know, what was going on at that time, they did a perfect job. Absolutely. And I reflect on that and just think, yep, there were so many wonderful things that you did. There were less wonderful things that you did, but it's all contextualized. It all makes sense. And this is one of the crux of the parenting that, you know, that I live within, is that everything makes sense. When you look at the context, everything makes sense. We look at the, you know, the unmet needs or the pent up feelings that drive behavior. It helps us just plug into this intense sense of compassion and understanding and patience. Mm. Right, it's a bottomless well of you know, capacity to hold everything.
Yeah, that idea that even when people do the most fucked up things, you can actually have compassion for how that has arisen in them is pretty revolutionary, I'd say.
And that it's not an effort to be compassionate when you come at it from this angle. There's no trying, there's no like trying to find the compassion. It's just it is there, like it's online, it's ever present.
Can you say more about that? What do you mean?
Well, when we remove the barriers to it, like this is just innate human. You know, this is just innately human. This is just who we are. We are compassionate. Mm. And when we remove the obstacles are things like, you know, dismiss, deny, patronize, you know, when we come across something that doesn't fit what we believe we should be, or what is good or what is acceptable or, you know, acceptable behavior, straight away we're just like demonize, you know, this is terrible, this is bad, we'll do it in ourselves and we'll do it in others. Mm-hmm. And so as children, so this is where this parenting for me comes in, is when we accept everything that our children bring with this understanding that, hey, there's a good reason, you know, my first assumption is there's a good reason for whatever it is that's going on. Mm-hmm. We can listen for that, and it inevitably comes out very quickly that, ah, okay, makes sense. It makes sense that you feel this way. Oh, I can really see that.
Now I'm wondering if that sense of acceptance and idea of listening can be then used to really see where we're at as a people. Do you feel a sense of like there's inevitability about where we've gotten to as a culture, or do you still kind of rage against it?
I do both. I rage against it a lot of the time, but then, you know, I always come back to remembering, hang on a second, this makes perfect sense. You know, follow the thread under these circumstances. This is, and look, I had, full disclosure, I had a very profound training around this on a personal level. So one of my jobs when I was, I think, mid-20s, like, you know, sort of, I think I finished, started around 25 and finished around 28, was working with young people inside the prison system. And I needed to find, I needed to find a way to see the good in them. And so it was over a few years of going, well, hang on a second, why have you done what you're doing? Why did this happen? And these were, you know, heinous crimes, awful crimes. And yet it was my job to support these guys and to support them coming out of prison, integrating back into society. And, you know, in order for me to be able to do my job effectively, I needed to find a genuine, you know, authentic part of myself that really did understand their story, that really did understand where it was that they came from and what it was that was actually driving the behaviours. So when I then came to be a parent, it was like that I was drawing on. It's like, my baby's not trying to manipulate me. My baby's not trying to, you know, deliberately trying to wind me up. My baby's not entitled or self-centered. Like, this is my baby's just here, you know, trying to get a need met. My job is to find out what that need is, to meet it. And you know, one of the things that we miss out on in parenting is that we think that or we don't consider that crying is also a need. That's one of the needs. We just need to have a cry sometimes. We just need to complain. We just need to offload all of the stress and the strain that's been loaded on us throughout the day. We often look at kids and go, oh, they haven't got all this stress and strain. But when we scratch the surface, they really have. We live in a very fast, loud world that's completely set up for adults, and just looking at the size of chairs and tables and, you know, where the door handles are, and it's disempowering. It's highlights their weaknesses, and they have a lot to complain about by the end of the day.
Okay, so working in a prison in your 20s is intense. What's the background to that? How did you actually get interested in why people are the way they are, and then how we actually grow them up?
I think by the time I stepped into this world, we'd already come a long way, right? So the feminist movement had already, you know, washed through and things were happening. So I think the next step that sort of became obvious to me as a 15-year-old was ageism, that we don't take, you know, young people's thoughts and feelings and preferences. You know, I was outraged that we didn't get to vote. Like, that's a ridiculous concept to me. Like, why wouldn't, 14, 15-year-olds be able to do that? So I was disgruntled. I was annoyed at that. I was annoyed at the, groupings that we had in the school system and, you know, this is the rate and pace that you need to go at, and these is the levels that you need to pass through, and this is the time you need to get up in the morning, the time you need to go to bed at night, and this is, you know, all of these constraints, which I just thought were ridiculous and didn't apply to me or a lot of the people that I knew. So I went, so my first degree, or my only degree, my first degree, listen to me.
Go on, reel them off.
Was in youth studies. So I studied child and adolescent development. And from there, I sort of worked my way through, you know, I was looking for my, you know, where's my point of efficacy? Where can I make the biggest difference for young people? And I went through, you know, child protection. I'm like, oh, look at me. I'll be like Charlie's Angels going out and saving children. But, you know, I got clear on that pretty quickly, that that's not how that system works. So from there, worked with homelessness organisations, mental health organisations. I worked on a couple of like wilderness therapy programs and, went through the whole gamut of those before I went, no, where, like, I need to find something that's actually really, like, give me the worst of the worst, like, throw it at me here, like, where can I really be helpful? And that's how I ended up in the prison system.
Oh my goodness, at such a young age to have that level of insight around, you know, your own experience and then how you can apply that in a helpful way back, you know, onto your peers and onto people. Like, it's incredible to me that a 15-year-old would have that degree of insight and understanding. Have you ever doubted yourself, or has this trajectory been like pretty obvious and kind of linear?
So I think after, I went down other paths. Okay. But that was after that, I decided that the system was so incredibly broken and that, you know, I could make a difference, but it was on a very small scale. I like to actually change, you know, it's like that whole, you can't fix a broken system with the same thinking that created it. It's like, I need to do something from outside the system in order to genuinely make a difference. And so, but I didn't know how. So I left the welfare sector and effectively ran off and joined the circus. So I went on the
naturally.
I went on the festival circuit in the US with a friend of mine who was a costume maker and stage decor a dozen or more different festivals that ended in Burning Man in, I think that was 2009.
Wow.
And so that was a 2-year sort of, you know, step out of that system and go, well, hang on, this is a bunch of people. I mean, there were 3 rules for our little posse, which was, does it look good? Was the rule number one, you know, it needs to look good. Does it feel good? It needs to feel good. Because if it's not those first 2 things, then it's not worth doing. Like, and to have that real like orientation shift from this, you know, driven and sitting inside of this, you know, quite intensely uncomfortable situations, intensely uncomfortable, it's kind of an understatement, that, you know, to have that contrast, I think was really important for me to really go, oh, hang on a second, there's got to be, what is the alternative thinking to this? Like, how can we do things differently?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe I take sentiments like that and kind of put them through my own filter and biases, but what I see happening so often and what I've noticed in myself is starting out with that young kind of impassioned energy of activism and doing good to others and having a bit of a moral lens, and then gradually tracking towards what is my heart desire and what is that wellspring of love that then makes every one of my actions from the micro to the, you know, maximum mean something. Is that kind of what you're talking about? Like coming from the, this is what I should be doing, to what actually feels good in my body and my my being.
So well said. And it's what actually works. Not just what I should be doing, following, you know, the systems and structures, the current systems and structures that were in place, and, you know, playing within that set of rules. It's like, okay, here's a whole other set of rules to play with here.
Mm-hmm.
What can I do? What can I do from out here? And from that point, I went and retrained as a yoga teacher.
Hi, Sid. That's Devin's boy, Sid, just dropping a camera back, which is, yeah, nice. He's just hanging out on the property here. I am so all about like the integration of everything into the audio, as you know. So yeah, acknowledging that. Your yoga training.
Yeah, and Sid is such a huge part of this. He really has been such a huge teacher. And I think one of the things that I talk to parents a lot about is that there's no such thing as an interruption with our children.
Oh my God, great.
And
let's bring it in.
Let's bring it in. And I'll often say, you know, in sessions with people, I'm like, oh no, if their child interrupts, I'm like, what did they just say? Like, actually, that's probably something really important that we need to listen to. Like, what is life saying through your kid right now? Like, it's probably an important piece. And with that sort of, you know, shift, you know, in thinking, people become a lot more, you know, accepting of children's interrupt, I'm using air quotations, you know, interruptions. It's like, oh no, these are welcome, you know, this is welcome input and welcome stimuli.
Whoa. All right. So wait a second. We're getting back to your history in a minute. But my friends with kids, it's just impossible to have a conversation, which is totally fine. But I wonder about, I know there's schools of thought around, don't give your kids that kind of attention because they're just learning to be monopolizing or dominating in a situation. Yeah. How do you respond to that? That difference in thinking.
It's not just about accepted and surrendered to. It's about, I need you to come and talk to me about things. I need your perspective. I need to hear your preferences, your needs, your desires. Like, I want this. Like, the world that my child is creating, the world that the children are creating, is going to be a far better world than the one that I can create, given, you know, given the rigidity of my mind now. Like, they've got so many innovative ideas and you know, ways of viewing things that they can, that they're the ones who are going to be able to change the world. And welcoming that as a practice, I think, just encourages it more and encourages a higher quality of interruption too. I think when we try to shut it down, it becomes this irritating thing and they get confused in what it is that they've come in to say. Whereas when I welcome, what happens with my child and what I see happening with my, you know, with the people that I coach, is that they come in, they say whatever it is that they need to say, and then they go back out again. And it's like over in a flash, and you've got something really valuable. Pop that in the pocket and get back to what it was that you're up to.
That is so brilliant. Mm. And so this is not spoiling our children.
No, and we're parenting, the number one thing is that we can't spoil them. You can't give them too much love. There's no such thing. That's a pervasive myth that needs to be debunked. There's no such thing as spoiling.
Okay, great. Yeah, I have read that, but yeah, I still find it really challenging based on how I was raised and how I see other people doing it. What else is kind of wants to be said, I guess, about your backstory that then feeds into what you're doing now?
We'll come back to that challenge. I'll just...
Just taking a big sip of ginger and dandelion root tea from our local co-op.
Delicious.
As well. Spicy.
But back to the backstory around, you know, so then I went on and retrained as a yoga teacher. So I'd come off that festival circuit, had come back into life here. And again, I was faced with this question of, well, how am I going to serve? You know, I've got my degree, I've got all these years of experience. It's like, and I've got this burning desire to be of service to young people. It's like, what am I going to do? And I'm like, I know, I'll teach them yoga. Like, that's going to save them. Everything will be fine. So got yoga certified and you know, got right into that, did a year-long course and meditation courses, and took that into the youth detention center and went, I'm here to teach you all yoga and how to meditate. Let's do this. And again, I was just met with the same thing. It's like, this is not a problem with the young people. This is a problem with the environment. This is a problem with the systems and structures that they're inside of. The fact that they're rebelling, the fact that they're behaving like this actually reflects really well on them. And that saying of, you know, it's not a sign of good health to be well adjusted to a sick society, like, that just rings in my mind all the time. So I'm looking at these guys going, what you're doing is completely functional. I don't want you to not do this. Like, be mad, like, be angry, be upset in the context of your life. This is the healthiest response.
So what do you do with that?
Well, and this is where then I, you know, so the history goes on. I then became pregnant and went, oh, holy crap. What am I going to do? Like, what do I do with this? Because, yeah, it is a healthy response, but it's also a very painful one and very painful to live inside of. And I don't want that for my unborn child. So what am I going to do differently? It's like, I've got to create this different environment. Huh, but I can't change what's out there. I can't change this wider, you know, systemic issues, but I can change the way that I parent and this little bubble that I put around us, around our family, around myself and my child. And that's where I was like, right, okay, let's look at different parenting paradigms. Let's look at these different approaches and find one that's going to actually work. And I started methodically leafing through which one's going to fit, and found aware parenting.
Okay. And that's the conclusion you came to for yourself, that kind of zone zero bubble, you and your baby. Do you think that's a good prescription for most people to kind of start there? Or do we still need people who are working at scale to kind of like pull different strings in the system?
To be honest, sadly, like and I'm happy for people to argue with me, but my personal view is, I think the biggest point of efficacy we can have is with children. And that if we get this, if we really focus here and we get this piece right, the rest is going to take care of itself.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And this has been this hunch that I've had for a really long time, but I don't have the rigor or the being botheredness to kind of back myself in some, you know, with some intellectual spiel about why that is so. But again, this is why I was so drawn to speak to you, because I don't see the way we parent as separate from learning ancestral skills or things that are going to help build resilience into the future. I actually think, fuck me, this is like the conversation to have about a collapsing civilization. Oh, actually we can just bring it right home. Mm. And isn't that so much more achievable for every single person? And again, like thinkers like Tyson Yunkaporta, when he brings that Indigenous perspective in of the network effect of like just bloody like come back to your people.
Yes.
One person. Like if we all did that, amazing.
Yeah.
That's done. Yeah. But for some reason we love to stretch and reach over there and neglect the thing right here.
Yeah.
It's just not as sexy.
Well, and it's harder. I think it's easier to look outside of ourselves. When we start looking inside of ourselves, and as you'll know with family systems, like it's a mess. Like you said, it's a mess in there. It's like, how do I even start with this? It's so much easier to point the finger outwards at others and not look inside.
The cockatoos are angry about that as well.
Oh, outrageous.
They're screeching like mad people. Okay, one thing I really liked on your website was the idea of there's business as usual, there's parenting as usual, and you as an aware parenting practitioner, coach, and actually I should clarify what you call yourself, but you're disrupting parenting as usual. So I wonder if you could set the scene, the current kind of status quo when it comes to raising children and doing the parenting thing.
Okay, so currently it's still widely accepted that we use punishments, rewards, bribes, that this is the way that, you know, we work from this behavioralism perspective from psychology. That's like we can make the behavior we want to have happen. Mm-hmm. And that is, yeah, for me, it's just so erroneous and so problematic and just absolutely chips away at trust, chips away at safety and security over time and destroys relationships. And there's no like light way to say that, but as long as we're employed, and I still do it, like I'm not going to pretend that I don't, I still fall back on that from time to time, but when I do I name it. I'm like, oh, you know, I'm, well, actually my child names it. I can see what you're doing, that's not very aware parenting of you. And I'm like, oh,
all right, wise guy.
So that, for me, that's like one of the biggest ones. It's like, how do we do away with that? And aware parenting's got some really great tools that mean we don't, that we don't fall into needing to punish and needing to bribe or needing to reward.
What's the alternative to that?
So just for anybody who's listening, if this is you, that's so normal. It's so, so normal. It's deeply ingrained in our society. And that this approach wouldn't have a magic bullet for a single episode, for a single incident. But what we do is we build over time. Mm. Like it's a cumulative practice that we establish an understanding and we establish agreements, right? Like how things operate, how things work. So there's a level of predictability and a level of understanding. And then it's more about reminding our child at that time about, well, how, you know, what it is that we need to do. But it's also, you know, in that moment, I would be recognizing, if that was my child and that was my situation, I'd be recognizing that, there's some feelings on board here. And if I listen to those feelings, if those feelings get some airtime, if that little girl gets to complain for a little bit, she's going to come right back into balance and she's going to go right back to being the innate human, you know, the cooperative, right, connected, wants to contribute. Well, that's what ends up happening in families that operate in this way. It's like everyone's like fighting to, you know, help each other and to do something to make life better for others, because that's where they get the dopamine hit from. Like that's the reward. It's this innate internal reward system of, you know, being a part of a family, of belonging, of, you know, really making a meaningful contribution, making a difference.
Oh my God, I want to pop out a kid now so I can experiment on it.
Yeah, right.
This is so magical, Devin.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't want to skip over the aware parenting philosophy and, you know, the real flesh and bone of what that is. So maybe if you could illustrate, give some examples around what aware parenting is as this alternative.
Okay, yeah, for sure. And I think most people, I imagine most people listening will be very well grounded in attachment parenting. And so you understand attachment parenting. So, you know, keeping our kids close, you know, we've got physical proximity, we're meeting needs promptly. Like if some, you know, if there's a cry, we think, is it needing something to eat? Are they needing to sleep? What's going on for our baby at that time? And so meeting those needs promptly. So this is built on attachment parenting. There's no argument with attachment parenting. Like, so for anyone who's read The Continuum Concept and those books, brilliant, right? Like this is foundational. From that place, we then add two extra elements to it. So one is that this non-punitive discipline, right? So we don't do rewards, punishments, right, or bribes. We meet any sort of teaching that we think we need to do, or any sort of, you know, redressing of behavior. We look at, we use play. And so there's a specific 9 styles of attachment play that we've got, and we practice those, and then we know what to pull out at any given time. Or better still, our child knows. They'll come to us after they've started playing these types of games. They come to us with the, hey, can we play this one? Can I play that one? Or just initiate that play, because they know what they need in order to come back into balance. And then the other part of it is this understanding that, you know, it's pent up feelings, that there's trauma that needs to be released, and that that's another need. And so we just need to listen to kids cry from time to time. And actually, when I say time to time, it's more likely on a daily basis in our current world.
Yeah.
And that time needs to be set aside for emotional release.
Wowza. Okay, play. This is good. This has not really featured on the podcast before. We are a serious podcast operation that does not indulge in such playful pursuits, but I do feel like play is such a game changer. And yeah, tell me more about how that might help adult people as well.
So play, laughter, crying, these are all about releasing, you know, releasing emotions. And so with the play, we're both accessing laughter, where we can release tension, you know, let go of embarrassment, we can dislodge all sorts of feelings, but we're also able to process, like emotionally process. So within these different styles of play, there's room for, you know, say one of them is separation games. So, you know, all of the times in my life where I was, you know, wasn't able to be with my mum, or my dad left for work every morning and didn't come back until 6 o'clock at night. Like, for every time that's happened, it's like there's a little part of us that's gone, ouch, ouch, ouch. Mm. And all of those ouches over time build up. So when we get a chance to play these separation games, and they're as simple as a game of peekaboo, right? Oh, I'm here. Oh, I'm not here. Oh, I'm here. Oh, I'm not here. Or hide and seek when your child gets a little bit older. We often play hide and seek before a separation and right after a separation, and it just, the connection just comes back online in an instant through playing those reunion games.
Wow.
So that's one example, and there's a whole bunch of others.
Oh, can you give a couple more? Because I feel like these, again, it's like when you find out that nursery rhymes have they have lessons and history embedded into them. Yeah, this is what I'm feeling about these games, which have just been completely they're abstractions for me, or things that you do as a kid that you never return to, but they've actually got a function.
Mm, mm. I used to call it purposeful play, but it's very much, it's called attachment play. And so another one is power reversal games, and these are amazing. So this is for when kids are feeling, which they feel frequently, weak, right, incompetent, or perhaps powerless. And this, like I said earlier, you know, you live in a world where the chairs and the tables and the doorknobs and somebody else has got the keys to the car and somebody else has got the credit card, right? Like, these are all things that make you feel powerless and unable. So we play power reversal games, which can be, in our house, it's a game of push me down. So I'll strut around the lounge room going, I'm so big, I'm so powerful, I'm so strong, you're never going to be able to push me down. My child comes up, gives me a shove. I fall down dramatically and go, oh my God, how did you do that? That's ridiculous. You'll never be able to do that again. And I get back up, and we play over and over and over again until he gets that embodied sense of, you know, he knows that it's a game. He knows that it's a joke, but it's having that embodied sense of power, having that embodied sense of strength means that you don't get into power struggles with your child. There's nobody trying to one up somebody else because they've got this outlet for it on a daily basis. And then,
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And I'm thinking too of when little kids ride their daddy. Kicking him in the guts like a bronco.
And so in that instance, dad's responsibility is to act like he's really hurt. Oh God, oh no, you've taken me out. Oh God, no, please don't do it again. No, no. Right? The kids start laughing, and as soon as they start laughing, you're like, brilliant, repeat, repeat, repeat.
Yeah.
Like, this is healing. This is, you know, them coming back into balance, where they can be in touch with those innately human qualities of wanting to cooperate, wanting to contribute.
Okay, and so that idea that this is a cumulative process, that it is like a whole picture rather than a panacea that you kind of apply and then you're all good, that rings really true for me working in the health space and with herbs that aren't like drugs. They don't have a single direction of action. It's a whole kind of system effect that builds up over time. So when people come to you with, I don't know, like what age kids are you working with families? Is there a limit?
Nope, we go to all ages.
Okay, I'm getting on the phone to mom straight after this interview.
Yeah. Pregnant ladies come to us, absolutely. It's like, oh goodness, I've got this, you know, and people with teenagers, it's all ages.
Okay, right. But yeah, if people are feeling, you know, the excitement of hearing that this exists and these possibilities exist in aware parenting, but then they're so far removed and struggling hard with the way things are done in their household culture. Like, where do you make a start with people?
Well, that's a good question. We start wherever they're at. We absolutely start wherever they're at. I think that most people come, like these days, most people come with the you know, attachment viewpoint. So we would start with play and then move into the, you know, releasing through crying and laughter. So once that's that foundation of safety and trust has been built, and it is, you bring your problem, I prescribe a game, and then next week you bring whatever happened as a result of playing the game and we tweak it or change it a little bit, and then you get more games, and we sort of roll on like that until enough safety and trust has been built, and then we can start incorporating the what we call crying in arms, or, you know, deep empathic listening, and add that in, because that's, we're not really able to get there until we've restored safety and trust.
Okay. Yeah. And yeah, I'm keen to really understand your inner workings, because I think that's inherently fascinating for me and for people listening. And what I am wondering is, you know, you have this such an expression of like, this is your thing and your niche and your expertise, but what are the hard lessons that you've learned throughout this journey, and what are some really sore points, I guess, for you?
Yeah, choosing this as the, you know, and I could have gone a different direction with the, you know, after sort of stepping out of the welfare sector and going through, you know, yoga teaching, I could have taken, because parenting is, you are just on display 24/7, like, your at night time when my child's crying in the house, and it's like, oh god, what do the neighbors think of me right now, because I am, you know, practicing this empathic listening, or when I've lost it and yelled, you know, oh god, what, you know, is somebody going to ring child protection? I'm like, how is this? It's such a excruciatingly but exquisitely painful process, I think, to go through this level of self-examination with this level of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And yeah, choosing this, I'm glad that I did, but I, yeah, it's definitely not for everybody.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And one question I wanted to ask was around village support for parents, and how that saying, it takes a village to raise a child, works in your life. You know, we both live in the same community. It's incredible. There's basically no niche unfilled in this wholesome, you know, and supportive place. How does the village play into your parenting of Sid?
I've had it both ways. I've had the stark contrast of not having any village at all. And there was quite a few years early on where, as a single adult household, and quite isolated, and then now having come back to our beautiful community and being able to forge the relationships that I have now, the village plays a huge role, but it doesn't have to be the village that I have now. Like, when I look back on those times of isolation, there were so many sort of incidental people. I don't know if I can say that. Like, there was a particular lady at the supermarket who really saw me and saw my child, and I made sure that, you know, when I was down there, that I would, you know, not seek her out, but make eye contact, say hello, and just go, I know that you know that you know that I know. We see each other, right? And, you know, the librarian, and, you know, there were these touch points in my day where I could, you know, connect in and just feel validated and feel, yeah, seen. I think but now having what I have now is like, whoa, wow, I can just imagine how life might have been then had I had this level of support, where a daily basis, very meaningful contributions get made to me through all sorts of things. So it's not just emotional support that I get now, where I'm able to talk about my feelings quite openly, and I'm able to cry quite openly with friends, and also in structured women's circles, mm-hmm. and other things. But I'm also able to get really high quality thought partnership, where I'm able to sit down and have extraordinarily interesting conversations like this, and really nut out what it is that I'm up to and where it is that, how is this working, and this stage is coming up, and what's that about, and what am I going to do differently here. So getting into the nitty gritty of it, mm-hmm. but also that practical support. Like, who do I call when I need someone to, not hold my child anymore. He's now 10, but,
He's very squishable.
When I need to go and do something, I've got an appointment over here. And so all of this, those pieces all come together now. And I'm like, wow, I don't know how I did it without it. I did. But having that level of support now is just off the charts.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that idea that even people with whom to converse and grist over things is part of the picture to support a family. It's not simply offering some free childcare every once in a while or bringing a meal. It's that emotional piece as well. Yeah. And Meg Ullman, when did I release hers? It's like episode 3 maybe. Yeah. Her women's circle is just completely cathartic and transformative for so many folks in this community. Having a place where we can learn to witness each other. Mm. And actually I was with someone yesterday who just broke down. And hi Sid. 20 more minutes? 20? Yeah. This is great. It's like volleyball hand signals. Who just kind of broke down, who just needed to break down like that. And being part of the women's circle gave me the confidence to just sit there and hold that space for her without flapping around and trying to look for a hanky or shut it down.
Or fix it.
Yeah, is this what we do when our children are releasing? Is it about witnessing?
That's exactly it. That is exactly what we need to do. So we try to meet all the needs, and first we do what we can to, and if we've got a baby, we need to be really responsive to those, physiological needs first up. And once we've addressed all of those, and then we get to the point where we're like, I think you actually just need to cry. So I'm just going to be right here with you while you cry. And I'm going to, calm my nervous system and get myself like physically comfortable. Maybe I'm going to sit on the couch, wherever I'm going to be, I'm going to hold you. I'm going to maintain eye contact. Mm. I'm going to maintain the faith and trust that, hey, you're going to feel so much better on the other side of this. And, I'm right here and I'm listening, and please tell me all about it.
I don't think I cry enough. And it's inconvenient, that's why. It's because I look like a goldfish with those big bobbly eyes on the side of my head. I get really blotchy and red. And so I avoid that level of intense emotion.
And I also think we, as a community, as a society, avoid that level of intensity because there's not that many people who have the capacity to be able to listen like that. And that it needs to be witnessed. You need to be with someone in order for it to come out, and there needs to be the time and space, and there needs to be the reassurance that, hey, your feelings are not too much for me. Like, I can listen, and as long as you want to cry, let's do that. And in this time poor community where we're running from one thing to the next, it's like, oh, hang on a second, if this is going to take an hour, I'm good, I've got you, let's go.
How do you have that spaciousness in your life? Do you?
I create it. Part of aware parenting, one of the pillars of it is that we have listening partners. So every week, every single week without fail, and sometimes I'll even leave messages in between these, but we have a 20-minute space we're down to now, but it used to be longer, but now I'm a bit more efficient at it. And any feelings are welcome. So she's my listening partner, my current listening partner. I've had different ones over the years, but my current one is just, oh my God, she's incredible. We've just created this space that's, you can say anything and nobody's going to call the police. Nobody's going to call child protect. Nobody's calling anybody. You get to say whatever you like. And if it's anger, if it's rage, if I want to spend the whole time swearing, it's totally fine. If I want to spend the whole time crying, totally fine. So whatever comes up for me on the day, you know, that's what happens. And yeah, I can leave messages in between times as well. So
wow. Okay. And so is each call or meetup dedicated to one person, or do you swap?
So different people do it differently. In mine, it's we get 20 minutes each. So I go first, and when I'm done, I say thank you so much for listening, and she says thank you so much for sharing. I so value all of your feelings and all of your needs, and this makes so much sense, and thank you so much. It's an honor and a privilege to listen to you. Yeah. And then off she goes and has hers.
And is that something that's unique or owned by the aware parenting community, or is it something that everyday people can say, hey, that sounds really good, I don't have someone who listens to me like that in my life, I want to set up a listening partner? I mean, can anyone do that?
Anyone can do this. And I think it's come from, there's another similar practice called co-counseling, or peer counseling, and I think Hand in Hand is another parenting approach that has a similar, you know, empathy buddies, they might call them, or we call them empathy buddies. I can't remember. But no, nobody owns it. Everybody should have a listening partner. I think that if we all had listening partners, things would be quite different.
Totally.
I know that I'm incredibly different as a result of having this. And again, it's another cumulative process. And I remember when I first started it, how difficult it was, and how then I had to have a lot of listening sessions around how difficult it was for me to have listening sessions, right? Like I would talk about that in my sessions, and finally got to this place where it's like, oh, I'm just hankering for a cry. I'm just hankering to swear. I'm just hankering to have a tantrum. I just need to release this.
This is such a whole life practice, isn't it? So many takeaways for people who, as I've mentioned, might not even have joined the dots between parenting and how they are in the world, or have any kind of interest in that subject. So I'm feeling extremely affirmed in having you here and having a conversation, because this is endlessly applicable, you know, to my life and to, I'm sure, everyone's life. I want to talk about leadership, because that really stood out to me as part of your write-up, your beautiful website. I'm thinking about Sid, who's outside just exploring and having a good time and periodically coming up and kind of checking in and feeling like he's just an incredible human, and how you're working together with Sid to kind of grow each other is phenomenal and so different to what I've seen before. In terms of like leadership, I'd love to know how you define that and what someone like Sid might actually do in this world that so desperately needs radical leaders.
Leadership for me is not about, you know, being out in front or being the biggest person or being in charge. Leadership happens at any level and every level. And I already view him, and I viewed him as a 4-year-old and as a 2-year-old, as a leader. And that he was, you know, in many respects leading me, and still is, leading me, you know, closer to myself and to a greater understanding of who I am, and, you know, what my values are and what my expectations are, you know, for better or for worse, you know, what it is that I'm expecting. He's absolutely. So the idea that, you can be a leader wherever you are, and it's about how inclusive you can, I hate that word, how you can, you know, help the people around you, how it is that you become a support, you know, what problems are you solving or working towards solving, how are you contributing? Including everything, you know, is, you know, being accepting of everything around you and being accepting of every part of every person around you.
Yeah.
I think nothing is too big for me. Nothing's too scary. It's like, you know, come to me with what you've got going on. That's to me is a leader. And I remember when I was working in the prison system, that my boss there was an incredible man, Peter. He was probably the first manager that I went, oh my goodness, you're like, that's what it means to be a leader. And I'd come back from being out all day, and I think it was like 6 o'clock at night or something, and I was back at the office late and dropping off the car and putting the keys away, and I was on my way out, and I saw there was a room, a big recreation room at our offices for the boys to hang out in, and there was a light on in the toilet. And so I walked in to turn it off, and there was Peter in there with, this is the manager of the whole centre, you know, managing 50-odd staff. And he had on big pink rubber gloves. One of the boys had come in drug affected and had vomited in the bathroom, and he was in there cleaning it up.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is leadership.
Yeah. Do they make gloves in any other colour than pink?
No, they don't. And when I said to him, you know, what, you know, hang on, why are you doing that? Why isn't the cleaner or somebody else doing that? He's like, I'm not leaving this for somebody else to do.
So having kids is quite the topic for discussion when one is hypothesising about how things will unfold in a civilizational sense. When is the shit going to hit the fan? What do you reckon? What do you reckon about having kids in this day and age? What about people who are too afraid to bring new beings into this situation?
Well, it's kind of, I see a little bit of a problem with it in that the more intelligent people see the greater problems with it. And they're the ones that we need to be having children. however, you know, I don't have a strong position on it either way. I haven't waded into that thought for, you know, since I had children, since I decided that I was going to have a child. So, yeah, I don't know.
Okay, what was this other thing that I wanted to ask you? There's so much I wanted to ask you, Devon. Oh, schooling. I think that's a huge thing. That is such a thing that people have asked me about. I'm like, well, how the fuck should I know? But what are the options, and how do kids play into that decision-making process as well, if you don't want to just send them through the mainstream system, or if you do want to do that, but in a really considered way? What have you done?
So right now my child is at school. We started homeschooling, but because of the family situation, I mean, everyone's going to have different constraints. So there's no judgment. My preference would be homeschooling. I think that that's probably the smarter way to go. However, you know, and especially like post-pandemic, you know, changes with online programming, that there's so many supports and resources available for children to be able to, you know, to be able to access curriculum, so to speak. But so much learning happens through play, and I think that almost every valuable life lesson that you want to give children, if you start applying attachment play, you can, you know, give all of those ones over. Children's innate and, you know, desire to learn. If we just don't get in the way of that, they're going to pick up everything that they need anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Learning's a really good topic, because I feel like school just got in the way and thwarted my own natural curiosity, and also my love of learning and self-directed learning. And so I've been left as an adult completely cut adrift because I'm just used to being told what to do. So unless I kind of mimic that authoritative voice from above and set hard deadlines and kind of flagellate myself, I find it actually quite hard to do things that are necessary or that I want to deepen into, because there's this schooling kind of hangover that I have. So are you anti-school for that reason, or like, what do you have to say about learning in general?
I'm going to be bold here.
Oh, please do.
I am anti-school, to be perfectly honest. I don't think it's a healthy environment. You know, to me, it almost looks like, you know, you get a bunch of cows in a feedlot and, you know, they're not getting what they need in there. And people say to me, oh, but what about socialization? I'm like, yeah, it's not really socialization now, is it? You know, forcing children to hang out just with their age mates that's not preparing them for society. I don't think there's enough room for innovation or creativity, and neither one of those are celebrated in there. And that's what the world needs. The world needs innovation and creativity right now. It doesn't need more people who know how to multiply and divide and add, although that's very important too. But, you know, I think that, yeah, schooling thwarts learning, like you said.
Yeah. So how do we then bring that back online, that intrinsic motivation?
Well, the focus on play, putting the focus on play, really, yeah, coming back to that. I mean, we live in a society where it's, you know, we have to, like, we don't have choice around schooling. There's no choice. We have to do it. So like it or not, that's what we do. So I think what I do a lot with my child and what I've done over the past few years is that we play power reversal games around it. So, you know, Will, at the end of the day, he gets to be the teacher and I'm the naughty student, and we play it out. And so we're sort of undoing as much of it as we possibly can. And thankfully, despite 3 years at school, and he's only 10, and usually the wheels fall off sort of 11 or 12, so, you know, it's about grade five that most kids go, okay, well, actually, if this is learning, I don't want to have a bar of it anymore. But he's still very much connected to his love of learning and is very interested and very curious and wants to read and experiment and play with things. So I'm imagining that my, you know, me playing and undoing any of the trauma that happens at school is going to be enough to keep him connected.
Yeah.
And then the other idea is just sort of like grease him up and get him through there. Like,
what's your preferred grease? Lard, tallow, schmaltz?
A combination of all of the above. But just, yeah, it's the play, you know, yeah. It's the separation games at the start of the game, at the start of the day and at the end of the day, you know, quick game of hide and seek on the way out the door. And, you know, nonsense play is another really important one where that's where, you know, I get to exaggerate being, you know, confused and silly and, you know, stupid, like not knowing things that I'm supposed to know. So the more I can play at that, the more he can laugh and the more he can release the trauma, the accumulated trauma that happens as a result of schooling.
Because Sid is a gifted kid. Do you want to talk about gifted children at all?
I think it's loaded, yeah. And I think it's difficult. And I know that it's plastered all over my website because that's my sort of my niche market.
Yeah.
But this is not restricted to gifted kids. And we've got a very narrow way of measuring giftedness that I think doesn't include, you know, we can only measure for the intellectually gifted, which is great and wonderful, but there's other, I mean, and there's not just like there's other types of giftedness, there are specifically other types of giftedness. The research is very clear around, you know, psychomotor and the imaginal and sensorial gifted, like these are real. Emotionality is another, you know, type of giftedness. So these are all very real. We can't measure them. It's difficult to have a conversation. We could have one, but that would take another hour.
Yeah, no, that's all good. Just wanting to acknowledge that is a part of your work.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Does Sid want to come in? Do you want to come in, Sid?
Are you done?
We're nearly done. I reckon maybe I've got one more question for Devon. But did you want to... Like five... How are you feeling, Devon? Maybe 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah?
It's been 1 hour.
I know, sorry. It's been an hour and two. Okay, mate. What is a wrap-up question? Like, you've really brought so many things home in a way that's just phenomenal. Like, normally interviews, people warm up around this 1 hour mark, and then I'm like, ah, shit, we gotta stop. You're just a torrent of insight.
There's a lot in it, isn't there? There's
so amazing, yeah.
I think maybe the wrap up might be that what, you know, my biggest takeaway from aware parenting is that it, and this is funny because we're off to a sustainability festival today, that this is sustainable parenting.
Mm.
This is not something that we get to, you know, it's like we're just trying to get through the day. We're just trying to get through the year. If we just get past the terrible twos, if we just get past, you know, the teenage years, this is sustainable parenting that is like slow release, you know, fertilizer for everybody. It's like we just get to really sink into this time. Nobody's wishing this time away. We're in it and we love it, and we're when people start adopting this approach, it just becomes almost cult-like. No. it becomes a joy. Like parenting becomes a pure joy, and I remember the times and I look at, you know, blips in my life, or I look at people who've not adopted a paradigm like this, and yeah, the pain and the complaint and the upset about it is like. And yeah, I know I mentioned before that it's painful to look inside, and it is, but it's it's a good pain. Like it's a growth pain, and it's a welcome one. So yeah, if my big take, my big sort of thing that I'd like to leave people with is that this makes it sustainable.
Thank you so much, Devin.
Thank you, Katie. This has been such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
If you're at all curious about a more compassionate and easeful style of parenting, I've linked Devin's website and offerings in the show notes. She works online too, so don't be discouraged by distance. And because the cosmos loves coincidence, I've actually had a few folks this week requesting more conversations around wild birthing and mothering and unschooling. So look out for those contrarian convos coming down the pipeline. Thank you, as always, for showing your support through listening, subscribing to, rating, and sharing Resilience. We're actually closing in on 10,000 downloads, which is super thrilling for a new podcast and extremely affirming. I'm glad these themes are chiming with you, and keep collaborating with me on what's next. You can reach out with suggestions and feedback at katie@katie.com.au or via a westbound black cockatoo. Catch you next Monday.